Good evening, good afternoon, good morning. Wherever you're at on earth, you are listening to Culture in Motion on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland and KBOO.FM on the internet. I've got a very special guest tonight on Culture in Motion. We're going to be talking about some fascinating, important, and frightening things. Roger Pete is in the building. And you all know, Culture in Motion is where art, culture, politics, music, activism all intersect. Roger Pete, how are you doing?
I am doing well, thanks.
It's been a couple years since I listened to the different versions of Abari Jema from Deep Within the Congo. Will you explain to our listeners what we're listening to?
Yeah, this is a recording from a church service in the former village of Obenge in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And this is the adult women's choir named Abari Jema performing a song written by one of the choir leaders from the village. And this village was a place that I stayed for about 3 months in 2012.
Wow.
Seems like a really long time ago now. It's the site of it was the only population center within the site of this plant, this like project to establish this new national park in Congo. And so as such, it was the site of a lot of contention about who gets to control the forest and the things inside it, the people and the animals and the trees, etc. And that contention between a local warlord and his allies and the incoming park project, which was a sort of conservation effort to some degree international, but also run by the National Conservation Agency in the Congo and a bunch of Congolese biologists and researchers.
Wow. So what was you said former village. There's a couple threads here I want to follow. You did mention that village doesn't exist anymore. What happened?
It doesn't exist anymore. It's a harsh story. It's a very harsh story. Like a lot of stories, you end up when you're talking about the Congo, often you end up talking about harsh things. Like in this case, this basically what happened with this village was that there was an end to the conflict in which the national army showed up in pursuit of a couple of deserters who had run away from the conflict to the east and were taken up with this local warlord. The army showed up to try to find them and decided that the village was a site of it was a haven for criminals and had to be ended. So they ordered everybody to evacuate and they burned the village to the ground.
Wow. So people you know lost everything and had to flee, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it came as a, there was a real pretty intense period of conflict between the warlord and his forces and some of the people in the village. Some people I knew were killed during that conflict. And then, when the army came, there was more conflict. Some of the people who I knew who were part of the warlord's camp were killed, and then everything sort of disappeared.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Damn. I'm sorry to hear about the loss of life, and condolences and power to the people who were the loved ones of those who were lost in that. Thinking about the park that was, you know, the project to establish the park was underway. Does that park exist in that area today?
It does. It has been formally established, gazetted. It is on the map. Mm. You know, like a lot of, you know, I've done a lot of thinking about, you know, what it means to participate in like works of conservation of that sort in the years since I participated in that. And, you know, like that park, it's not a thing that anybody's ever going to really visit as a, you know, in the way that we think about visiting right. national parks. You know, there are some national parks in Congo that people do visit, but they are extremely expensive and they're pretty much like access to them is restricted to people with a lot of money. And they're all pretty much like, you know, near big cities or the border.
Yeah.
This park is extremely remote. It's about as remote as it's possible to get. And so the only people from the outside who are going there are, you know, to visit it as a park per se, are scientists who are researching the fauna or the flora of that region. It isn't really a site of popular engagement with the land, you know, and of course, a lot of the tension that remains in the area is that it is a site of commercial exploitation from a lot of people who make their living hunting animals in the forest and selling the meat to markets in local towns and villages. And then also the more nebulous economy, which involves forest elephants and their ivory, which also includes, you know, there is a lot of corruption and involvement of the army in that. And that was a lot of what was going on with the warlord that I was talking about earlier, was his collusion with corrupt elements of the armed forces to extract, mm-hmm. you know, the extremely valuable resource in that area, which is ivory.
Man, it's so dense. And I think about the parallels, like just okay, so dense, right, as a description. And I haven't been to the Congo, but everything that I hear about it, and when I talk to people who are either from Democratic Republic of Congo or you who've been there a lot, I think about how layered things are. I think about, and I think, you know, the Amazon as well as the Congo are two of the most botanically dense and diverse places on Earth, correct?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, like, you know, the Congo is the second, I mean, I think it's correct to say it's the second largest, like, contiguous block of, like, mm-hmm. you know, tropical rainforest after the Amazon.
Right. Have you been both places?
I have been to the edge of the Amazon. I wouldn't say I've really been into it.
Yeah. Can you describe a little bit about what it feels like to be in deep, remote, dense nature in DRC?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I don't know. It's like no other experience I've ever had, you know, because when we were just so far away. I mean, geographically, like not actually that far from things, you know, compared to like the way we feel distances here in the States. But in terms of like difficulty of travel and length of time it takes to get anywhere, it was like we were so far away from anything else. And the forest is simultaneously like very beautiful and welcoming and also incredibly harsh and alienating. Mm. Like it is full of, you know, wonderful smells and just the worst smells imaginable. It is like full of like beautiful things and things that are very harsh. It is full of like wonderful textures and extremely sharp spikes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I can. I don't know what the figure is actually, but I once heard that something like half of the world's insects live in the Amazon by volume and species. And when I was there, I had this experience where I was, you know, taken away by the natural beauty that I was seeing with my eyes, but the sensation of the onslaught of insect bites, right? And out of respect for the local people who were hosting us, they were like, please don't bring DEET, you know, because they just, it's such a harsh smell to them. They don't want to have to deal with it. It's toxic. And so I suffered. And I remember it was around the time that monkeypox was a thing. And I remember being scared because I had so many bumps on my body. I was like, I got monkeypox. But it was just bug bites, you know. But that's life. That's what you encounter, you know.
I mean, I'm a big fan of insects, and I like to spend a lot of time looking at insects and thinking about insects. And this and that area in Congo was just like the insect diversity was just off the charts. But it was also, you would just have these very intimate experiences with insects that were just very strange. And I didn't, it was like there were certain things like, you know, these very small wasps that that would warn you if they were about to sting you, they would make a particular noise. But otherwise, you know, there was surprisingly little like sort of insect unpleasantnesses. One of the strangest things was just the honeybees in this one area that we were at, where we would, starting at dawn, we would get up and we'd have tea and like a couple of biscuits as quickly as we could, because as soon as the light started to intensify, the bees would find you and start to drink your sweat. And if you weren't moving through the forest, you would be covered in bees.
Wow.
So just like a layer of slowly moving, not aggressive, you know, just bees who are just like, this is delicious, wonderful.
Wow.
And just like hundreds of bees. And so you just have to move very slowly so you don't crush them. Because if you crush them, then they will sting you.
Right.
But otherwise, you are just like, it's this constant like low hum, and you're just being licked by a million tiny tongues.
Wow. Okay, so we have a lot to talk about. We didn't, you know, actually plan on talking about bugs in the forest so much, but I do because I have a platform. I've told the story to a couple people, but I have access to a larger audience. So I want to tell you a story about insect encounters and the strangeness. So here we look at bugs like a nuisance, and we don't really think of them. A lot of us don't think of them as conscious, like intelligent beings, right? And so I had this experience where there was a giant horsefly in my room. And I really didn't want to get bit by it. So I was trying to think about how to get rid of it, but I didn't want to kill it because I recognized and respected the fact that I was in its environment. Well, I finally got the horsefly to leave, but as I got the horsefly to leave through a crack in the door, a wasp that was twice the size of the horsefly, about as big as my thumb, comes into the room. So now I'm like, this is even worse than the horsefly. And the wasp was so intelligent. There was a screen on the window. The wasp flew to the corner, the top right corner of the screen, and this thing was so strong, it put its forearms and whatever would be the equivalent of its hands on the little squares, the minute squares that make up the screen, and it started trying to pry the square open to make it wider. And it was so strong, like you could hear it going pop, pop every time it tried to pull. So eventually I was able to get rid of the wasp by grabbing my face net that covers your face down to your shoulders, like a bug net with a little wire frame inside. And I was able to capture the wasp inside of that and then free it. So anyway, you learn to respect things that you have to share space with.
Indeed.
For sure. Now, you've been to the Congo a few times. With this recent project that you've been working on for how many years? I mean, you were connecting the Hanford Nuclear Reserve.
Yeah, I mean, this new project is, it's related to the history of the usage of Congolese uranium in the Manhattan Project. And that relates to the Hanford Reservation, which is the big, nuclear reservation in central Washington, which is where the Manhattan Project, which is the project to, you know, develop the first atomic weapons, that's where they built the facility to produce the plutonium that they used in the very first nuclear test, the Trinity test, and the Fat Man bomb, which was the one that they dropped on Nagasaki. And the Hanford Reservation is, you know, frequently referred to as the most highly contaminated single site in the Western Hemisphere, which is a, you know, a crazy thing to think about. You know, think about all the, you know, the pollution and all the, you know, the industrial disasters of, you know, that capitalism has produced in the West. And you think about like one place being the most contaminated out of all of them, and that base place being 3 hours from where we are right here, like right on, you know, on the banks of the same river that we are next to here in Portland, is a weird thing to think about. And the contamination at Hanford, you know, is a lot of it, maybe, you know, it's difficult to measure exactly, you know, what percentage of it, but certainly, you know, like a very significant amount of it is the result of the processing of uranium from a single mine in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that mine's name is Shinkolobwe. And that mine was the source of the most highly concentrated uranium ever found, and it the fact that it was so concentrated was the major determining factor in how the Manhattan Project was able to go from zero to bomb in 3 years. So, and it's like, and the thinking about, you know, like that, the presence of this contamination in that landscape is part of this, you know, part of the heart of like the project that I'm working on right now, which is this thing that I've been doing for, I don't know, I can't remember exactly when this started. But it is a project that is centered around a map that I've made, based on research that I've done into the history of this uranium from Congo, that traces the passage of that uranium ore through the Manhattan Project all the way from, you know, from Congo to all the different infrastructure that in which it was processed and used in the U.S., on the way to it being assembled into, you know, bombs in New Mexico and then delivered by the, you know, by bombers over Japan. And the thing about this, you know, this uranium ore is that because it was so powerful, and because they produced the infrastructure to process it and develop these technologies, because all the stuff that they were using to process and like develop the uranium, develop the bombs, they were all brand new. So they were doing a lot of it on the fly and just creating a lot of effluent, a lot of waste at every stage of the process. And so there's all these sites across the United States where you can sense the presence of that ore from that single Congolese mine in the landscape still to this day. In St. Louis, there's these huge zones of contamination. In upstate New York, there's in southern Ohio, of course, in New Mexico, in Hanford, and then just like a bunch of smaller sites around the country. And so I made this map that basically shows the passage of, you know, of this ore through the Manhattan Project, but it also connects back to you know, to the fact that this that you can, you know, like I was able to do a lot of research into, you know, the usage of this ore in these industrial facilities around the United States. But as soon as you go past that into Congo, like the story like disappears, the trace is gone. Like there is no record of the work done by Congolese mine workers who produced this material that basically enabled the United States to achieve a degree of, you know, hegemony that it would not have otherwise been able to achieve.
Man, so much comes to mind. I'm going to try to remember it all. Well, I think, first of all, thank you for not just looking at the material product of the extraction in the path, but also looking at the people where the material is extracted from, and giving shining a light on the fact that there are people there who recognize that this uranium that came from the places that they lived, that they mined, or people that they know mined, was used in these nuclear bombs. But a lot of people in the West and outside of Africa have no idea about the people, the place, or any of that.
Yeah. I mean, that was like, so it's, yeah, the, you know, when I was, like, so I've been working on this project for a few years, and I've made this map, right, based on all this research. And I've been in, and through the process of like doing this research, I was connected to this community of this like group of organizers in South Africa who are Congolese expatriates, because a lot of people, people who worked in mines in Congo went to South Africa, where there is also a huge mining industry, because the money was better.
Yeah.
And so there's like a big diaspora of Congolese people and people from other parts of like Central Africa in South Africa. And so there's communities of like, you know, Congolese expatriates who are, you know, who are also like aware of this history of this mine and the fact that the people who did this work are like not present in history. And they have a lot of stories from their, you know, parents, relatives about, you know, the consequences of working in the mine. Because you think about, you know, like, you know, people face pretty severe consequences in the U.S. There's like, there were people who mined uranium for the Manhattan Project in the Navajo Reservation, the Navajo and Hopi Reservations in Arizona. And that was uranium they were getting out of those mines that was probably at, you know, maybe up to 1% concentration. And the people who dug that ore were not, you know, were working in pretty like uncontrolled circumstances, and they were, you know, the subject of pretty racist exploitation. And eventually, as a result of a lot of activism, there was a degree of compensation like provided to them, like new houses were built, medical care, that sort of thing. But the people who mined the stuff in Congo were working with uranium ore that existed at up to 65% purity. And there has been like exactly zero effort to provide any kind of compensation or recognition of the fact that, of even the fact that they exist.
Yeah.
So these people in South Africa, you know, every year they put on a conference called Missing Link, which is an effort to connect people all over the world who are linked together by the history of Shinkalobwe's uranium. So people in New Mexico, people in Japan, and they're trying to create these connections and bring together people who are affected by this common thread of like what the uranium from this mine was used to do. And so I was, you know, like working with them, that like they connected me to some people in Congo, in the city Lubumbashi, which is nearest to the site of the mine. And so I went this year to Lubumbashi to take the map project there and to share it with people in that city and to see what connections I could make, you know, and how the project would resonate with people there. Cause like basically the map is it's a big linoleum block print. So like I've drawn this big map on linoleum. I've carved it and I've printed it on paper. So I took the block with me and did a lot of presentations to different groups of people, and then also did a couple of workshops where people participated in printing the block and printing copies of the map. And, you know, and being in Lubumbashi, it was a very interesting place to be. I met a lot of awesome people. It was a very powerful experience to be there, because the other previous times I've been in Congo, I've been in the capital, I've been in Kisangani, which is another large city, and I've been in like in very remote rural areas, and actually another city called Kindu. But this time I was just in the city of Lubumbashi, which is the center of the mining industry in Congo, and is just like the site of so much of Congolese history. It's a really fascinating place. But being there, you know, everybody I talked to knew the name of this mine. They knew that this mine produced the uranium that was used by the Americans to make the first atomic bombs. As soon as you say the name, well, the first thing that happens whenever you say the name is people kind of look around to see if they're supposed to be talking about this, because it is still the site of a certain degree of, like, you know, like, are we supposed to be talking about uranium and atomic weapons, you know, here in public? It seems fine. But it is still kind of intense. People are cautious.
Okay.
People are just want to be cautious about the sort of things that they are getting into, which makes perfect sense. But nonetheless, everybody knows the story. In the U.S., nobody knows it. You know, like, I've given presentations to, like, you know, people like Eastern Washington University, which is kind of close to Hanford. And nobody in the audience, you know, people who had worked at the Hanford site, people who were like, you know, like technicians in the, you know, who had come to my presentation hoping to like hear something about Hanford history. And then they hear something about this mine in Africa that they've never heard of before. And we're just like, what is this? What is this guy talking about? And in, you know, like there were so many, you know, there's apocryphal stories that like I heard from all these different people in Lubumbashi about. When I, you know, sort of like, you know, telling people like, I'm here to try to, you know, see to the degree to which I can find out about the history of the people who worked in this mine, you know, is it, you know, like, and that history is just not present. It's not accessible. Doesn't exist. Nobody ever recorded it. Or if they did, the archives are not available. But everybody I talked to, not everybody, but most, but a lot of people I talked to, told me the same story. It's like, you know, there's the story people tell about people who worked in that mine. And the story goes that whenever, you know, people were like down in the mine, digging the uranium out, and they would come up and then it would be like the weekend and they would go home to their village. And it's been a long week of work. And they'd go home to the village and they go into the village bar and there's a TV on in the village bar and they walk in and the TV goes all static. Just fuzzes out as soon as they walk in. And I heard that story from history professor. I heard that story from taxi drivers. I heard that story from artists at the art center that I was working with. Just all over the map. That's the story people tell about Shinkolobwe.
So Shinkolobwe, uranium ore, copper belt, all kinds. You talked about radium, lithium, manganese. All these things are occurring together. When you go there, do you feel, you talked about these sites in the United States, like Hanford and New Mexico, and you said you sense the presence of uranium. My mind wonders, and I'm sure a lot of other people do, is there a way to, what does radio, like being in proximity to radioactive material that can make the TV turn to snow when you come in the bar after work? Do you feel something, or like what is that like?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's just a story because I think it's just the thing that people say about that sort of, you know, about that experience. I'm not sure if people are actually, if you would actually cause the TV to distort if you came into the bar with a bunch of uranium dust on your clothes. But I guess I don't know. But in terms of, you know, like the actual presence and like ability to like to feel, you know, the presence of like radioactivity or whatever else in the landscape. Like I was not able to arrange a visit to any of the mining sites. I don't think I really felt anything by virtue of, you know, just being in the city. But I did talk to, you know, one of the people I interviewed while I was there was this professor of public health at the University of Lubumbashi's Institute of Public Health, Professor Celestin Banza-Lubaba. And he showed, and his work is assessing the health conditions and the health and like the sort of sanitary conditions of mine workers in the region. And mostly focusing on what is referred to as artisanal mine workers, because there's a formal industrial mining sector in Congo, which is like, you know, massive international conglomerates using big machines to just dig huge holes in the ground and then crush up the rock and process it, you know, through like a variety of industrial techniques. And that is, we'll say like that is like 70% of the mineral extraction, but the vast majority of the workforce in Congo that is doing the mining are artisanal miners. So there are people who are just out there digging in the ground with picks and shovels and lengths of rebar, levering chunks of rock out of the ground. Because the thing about that region, it is that it is one of the most mineralogically complex and dense and rich zones on Earth. And there's all of these metals, copper, cobalt, you know, zinc, nickel, manganese, uranium, gold, everything is there. I mean, it's all at surface level and it is all just mixed together. It's not separated. It's all just these huge melanges of rock. And a lot of the ore is, the name of the ore is heterogenite. Mm. So it's just this heterogeneous mass of all this stuff. So, you know, this professor, you know, he is studying, like, he is going to, like, for example, he showed me some photos of a recent trip he had done to this area where this, there had been lithium mines. And there are basically two big curves of mineral profligacy that converge on Lubumbashi. One that goes more directly to the north towards like the Kivu provinces in Rwanda, that is like sort of like referred to loosely as the tin belt. And that is full of, you know, these complex tin ores and lithium. And then there's one that sort of bends towards the west that is referred to as the copper belt, which is where most of the copper and the cobalt and the uranium is. But he had been working with people in the tin belt who were these artisanal mine workers who were working through the tailings piles of a huge Canadian-run lithium mine, right? So this was a lithium mine that had been in action for the previous couple of decades, and like the company that was running it got all the lithium that it wanted from the techniques that it was using and left. And this Canadian company showed up basically just to process the tailings, so the waste rock left behind. And so there was this, you know, large group of artisanal miners who were just kind of working on the edge of that operation, because the artisanal miners, you know, the industrial operations, it's very crude and rough. You know, you're looking for, like, they want the ore, but they don't have any means of getting it other than just, like, huge machine dig a hole. The artisanal miner can look at the ground and find the vein of ore and pursue it precisely. You know, like, I don't want that. I don't want the stuff to the left. I don't want the stuff to the right. I just want this stuff right here. And so they can pursue it, and they do. They pursue it into the ground. They pursue, like, you know, these veins of ore, or they go down into the ground, like, looking for, like, sites of mineral richness, and then they extract that themselves in the dark with headlamps and lengths of rebar and picks, and they bring it to the surface. Or they're working through the tailings piles, just like the big, you know, the big operations are. And, you know, this professor of public health, he showed me his, you know, like everywhere he goes, he takes, you know, these portable, small battery-powered Geiger counters to assess the conditions that he's working in, because you never know when certain things will be more radioactive than other things. And those small battery-powered Geiger counters are in use by a lot of different people in that area of Congo. Like there's a, you know, the formal trade in uranium is supposedly very tightly controlled, but because uranium is mixed in with everything, it is, you know, it is not as easy as you might think to say, okay, well, we're going to keep the uranium out of this enormous shipment of rocks that's going to China, because it's all just mixed up in there. And the, you know, like the Shinkolobwe mine itself was operated, you know, it was opened in the 1920s, and then later, you know, and it was mined for radium for 20 years because nobody had any use for uranium. The Manhattan Project comes along, and suddenly uranium's all they want. And then so the United States, like, imposed its very explicit direct control of that one mine for like the next 20 years, 15 years until 1960. What happened in 1960 was independence.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So that's the independence comes to Congo, and the Belgian Colonial Minerals Consortium, which operated the mine producing uranium for the Americans in their various nuclear efforts, shut the mine down. And that process of, you know, shutting down the mine to deny the mineral access to the Congolese, is kind of like, you know, mirrored in the contemporary scene where there is this like just apocalyptically insane scramble for cobalt in that region, and the you know, it has always been a sort of a desperate, chaotic, pursuit of these metals with no care for the exploitation of the workers involved. And, you know, the sort of cavalier attitude that people who want the metal have always had towards their mine workers has really, you know, like existed in this like really awful continuum from the time, you know, of the 40s when the people were mining this like uranium in Chincalubwe all the way through to right now where people are mining cobalt throughout that region at a level that is kind of unheard of in history. And just the sort of the chaos and like the damage to public health and the deaths underground and the mine collapses is just like completely out of control.
We can go back to, you know, an earlier turn of the century and look at the Belgian exploitation and extraction of the Congo. And we can read stories like Adam Hochschild's King Leopold's Ghost, right, where he talks about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people slaughtered, people having their limbs chopped off if they didn't do the bidding of the Belgian colonials. And these stories are common in the region, not just in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but in Rwanda and Burundi and so on. But when you talk about DRC, it's from what I have been exposed to in terms of information and learned, it seems like there's a long line of unbroken extraction and exploitation and genocide that hasn't really been recorded in terms of the record keeping, the amount of lives lost in terms of indigenous Congolese people. With the story that you're here to tell today, we're not going back to the 1800s and before. We're not going back to the beginning of the colonial conquest of the Congo, but we're starting with uranium. And we're seeing this connection between mining of uranium ore for the production of these nuclear bombs and the arms race, which really have a lot to do with the dominance of the United States as a global superpower, correct? Then we're coming a few decades later into the mining of cobalt, coltan for the batteries and lithium to power the electric cars. So on the one hand, some of us who are critical of the military-industrial complex on the left, you know, we also are people who are consider ourselves to be champions of the environment and alternate energy sources getting beyond fossil fuel. Talk about the irony there.
The irony is thick and rich. You can cut it with a spoon. It is very cruel, a very cruel fact. That, you know, after all of the other ways that Congo has sort of paid for the industrial advancement of the rest of the world, you know, through first slaves, mm-hmm. and then rubber, mm-hmm. and then copper, and then uranium, and now, this is a very crude timeline, and then now, like ending up with cobalt, which is supposed to be the means by which the industrial system that this, you know, this process of extraction is created is going to redeem itself.
Man.
You know, that is going to somehow release itself from the sort of rapacious grip it has on the planet and create some kind of system of where things can be nice and mm-hmm. and quote unquote sustainable.
Right.
But the irony is that, you know, that in order to produce the, you know, this supposedly like green revolution that we have to go straight all the way back to the same place that we always go for the means of transforming the world and the way we relate to it. I mean, it involves people in the Congo working themselves to death and not getting paid for it. And the contemporary scramble for cobalt is You know, like it was involved a lot of Western firms for, you know, for a long time. And then in 2008, most of the Western firms kind of they kind of cut their losses and left. There are still some operations there, but most of the operations that are currently like getting like, you know, these massive open pit mines and are Chinese firms. Mm. You know, the operations are mostly run by massive Chinese metals conglomerates. And so there are efforts to try to, you know, like all of these companies that are interested in presenting to the world that they are a part of this like ethical transformation of their, you know, their supply chain, like, you know, Apple and Tesla and Chrysler and, you know, like everybody who is like, you know, interested in producing, you know, battery powered vehicles, like they need cobalt to make those batteries not burst into flames and to hold a charge. And there is no way of getting that cobalt without having some significant percentage of the cobalt be produced by basically slaves in Congo and a lot of like child slaves, because of just the way that the labor works. People are just digging it up out of the ground and selling it to people who will buy it, and they concentrate it into increasingly large piles, and then somebody from a metals distributor who is going to take it overseas and smelt it, you know, buys it from them. So the labor, the invisible sort of like highly exploited labor disappears into the process. So there is no way for these massive institutions like Apple or Tesla or whomever is trying to say that they are like part of producing these like new green technologies to demonstrate that actually, you know, the material is not produced with this extremely exploited labor, because that's where all of it is coming from. And the, that, sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, it, the cell phones, you know, the device dependency, the computers as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all the rare earth precious metals that, a high percentage of the metals in each and every device that we use are from the Congo. And I think about the design obsolescence that you know, every time I get a phone or a computer, within 2 years, the charger is no longer useful because they've created a new port for the charger, right? Mm-hmm. Or their headphone port or whatever. And so these products that we're using as accessories and accompaniments to our devices, we're constantly having to throw them away. You know, they're not even designed to last long, which just further increases the intensity and rate of extraction, right? Mm-hmm. And that's by design.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's also by design is the fact that, like, we are now supposed to be looking forward to the transition of the entire United States vehicular fleet into a whole new. We're just going to get rid of all the old vehicles and replace them with a bunch of, like, you know, with what? 100 million new vehicles that are all going to be filled with enormous batteries that are made out of Congolese cobalt
by 2030, right?
Or I mean who knows? I mean, the actual like real world prospect of this is like a ridiculous pipe dream. The point is to generate the industrial activities that people can make a lot of money off of,
right?
You know, whatever the actual result is not really part of what people are really interested in, because what they are really interested in is making an enormous pile of money. And that's why the cars are very large. So they require very large batteries. And so like all of that stuff requires, you know, an increasingly like large level of industrial input and output that is just like involves, you know, more money cycling through the process and more profit. And it also involves more Congolese people getting underground and digging. And, you know, and this is, you know, this contemporary story is, you know, there's this great book about the contemporary scramble for cobalt called Cobalt Red that's written by this British journalist, Siddharth Kara, that I really recommend people read if they want a very comprehensive and just really brutal depiction of the situation on the ground. It came out I think it came out this year. But it, you know, it's one of these things that, like, you know, all of this, you know, the story, you know, of cobalt mining in Congo, it all traces back. It traces back into history to this mine, you know, the Shinkalubwe mine that produced the uranium for the first atomic weapons. And the thing about that process is that what that process did, you know, like digging this uranium out of the ground. And if you like, there was, you know, this movie that came out this summer, Oppenheimer, that is, you know, right. That's like a, like, it's like
they
a
don't even mention it.
A description. Well, that's the thing, is they do mention it.
Okay. Okay.
And it's like, if you are an obsessive about nuclear history and like, you know, like I am totally obsessed with this history, and I'm like watching this movie and like waiting for a mention of this mine, because it does not appear in history. And there's a point at which Matt Damon, you know, as Leslie Groves, says something about like, oh yeah, we got 1,000 tons of uranium to start the process off. And it's like that 1,000 tons was material that the Belgian director of the state mining consortium had. He had, when he saw World War II, you know, Germany, like, but was, you know, like overran Belgium, right? And, he said, I've got to get, and he's at the same time, he's seeing all of these scientists like speculating about the possibility of the power inherent in the nucleus of the atom, and that the research they are doing is on uranium. He's like, I've got all the best uranium in the world here. I better get it out of here. And so, you know, because the Shinkalubwe mine had been, for the first 20 years of its operation, a radium mine, it had all around the mine these giant piles of uranium ore that were just the tailings that were just left behind. So he loaded up that 1,000 tons of uranium ore, you know, the most powerful uranium ore on the planet, just sitting out there, and shipped it to New York City, so that when the Manhattan Project came to him and said, we hear you have some uranium, he said, actually, yes, I do. I've been waiting for you guys to show up. So he sold them that, and basically just sold them the rights to exploit that mine's uranium for the next, you know, for the foreseeable future. But in the, what the movie doesn't mention is that the movie goes into the fact that the Nazis also had a nuclear program.
That's right.
And the Nazi nuclear program was based on uranium from the Shinkalubwe mine that they captured from the docks of Antwerp when they overran Belgium in the first sort of, you know, in the early part of the war. So both sides were conducting their research into the possibility of nuclear weapons on the same rocks. And throughout the history, you know, I'm reading this history, like those rocks show up in the same barrels, stenciled product of Congo. The same rocks and the same barrels on this, both sides of the war. And so both of these, you know, these like behemoths, you know, of one of just like capitalism, one of fascism, that eventually basically merged together to form one like extremely unpleasant Voltron.
Right.
They were both trying to get to the same point, using the same material from Congo, and where am I going with this? There's a point I'm trying to make. where is the point that I'm trying to get to? I lost it.
Can I jump in,
yes,
for
please.
A minute, and then it might come back to you? I would be slipping if I did not kind of channel this information through a specific lens. There are 250 ethnic groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC. There are 700 distinct languages or dialects across its vast territory. One of the biggest countries on the continent of Africa. Literally the heart of Africa, the center of Africa. So what I think about when I listen to this, all the way from, you know, Oppenheimer to Black Panther, right, in the mythological vibranium. Think about the history of not only the United States of America, but Western civilization and its reliance, its continued reliance on the exploitation and extraction, brutal exploitation and extraction of human resources and natural resources from the African continent that provide, on the one hand, promise and prosperity, but on the other hand, untold suffering and wealth for very few, and apocalyptic power for very few at the expense of everyone on Earth. Yeah.
Well, I mean, one thing that is, you know, like it is when bringing it back to Congo, it is, you know, important to remember that, like, the, you know, the U.S. control of this mine caused, you know, and the things that the United States was able to do with Congolese uranium, which is basically to provide them a means to deny the future to anyone in the world that they didn't want to have access to it. Right. You know, like, this is, the world is ours now because we can destroy it.
Yep.
You know, when 15 years after the end of the war, Patrice Lumumba, you know, the first independent leader of Congo, gave the speech at the sort of accession, his, you know, the arrival of independence, in which he said, you know, to an assembled hall of Belgian dignitaries, like you people have exploited us for a long time and that's over now. We're going to take our world and make it for ourselves. We are going to, you know, the things that we have here, we're going to use for our own benefit. And that, and the assembled dignitaries were extremely shocked at the prospect that they were actually going to have to let the Africans have what the African soil, you know, provided. And so what that produced was that the Belgians and the Americans conspired to basically assassinate Lumumba and install in his place a leader who was more pliable and who would not deny to the West access to those materials, because, you know, the Shinkolobwe mine always presented, you know, the vision that something else might be there. Like, what else is there? If there's this thing that allows us this much power, what else could be there? There's no way we can allow the Africans to control their territory. We must always retain this for ourselves. So
the addictive greed at the center of it,
mm-hmm,
is unstoppable. It's insatiable.
Yeah.
This has been such an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Roger Pete.
Mm.
We've got to go in a minute.
Oh,
before
yeah.
we go, you've got a show coming up.
Mm, I do have a show.
Talk about your show. When, where, how?
Yes. So opening October 6th at Souvenir Gallery in Portland on Alberta Street. I don't know the exact address, but running through the month of October, I'm going to have an exhibit where I'm going to include the map and a bunch of other ephemera and art objects related to what we're discussing here today. And a lot of it is going to address the very strange and weird personal relationship that I have to this whole story, which is sort of based around the fact that my father was a helicopter contract pilot for the CIA in Congo in the 1965, in the basically the sort of like final throes of the CIA's effort to, you know, install its new system of control in Congo. And so that's like why I have this very personal connection to this story. And a lot of what is in that show is going to be an exploration of like of the personal qualities of like my connection, and by extension of that, all of our connection to the story.
I want you all who are listening to go check out the show. See the map. I'm going to make sure I get down there and check it out. I need to see if you actually glow in the dark.
Mm.
So shorter days on the way, you might get a chance to find out yourself. But think about, on a serious note, think about what's happening in Niger. Think about what's happening in these Western African nations that want the French and the French's neo-colonial structure out. And think about what happened in the Congo with Patrice Lumumba and independence from Belgium in 1960, and what we're talking about right now and how it relates to you. in the world.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the vast majority of French of French nuclear power is generated by Nigerian uranium.
Wow. Man. All right, thank you for listening to Culture in Motion. Support KBOO, you guys. Become a member if you're not. Go online, kboo.fm, KBOO. Is it kboo.org too? I don't know. Find out and donate. And keep listening to Culture in Motion. Thank you.
Peace. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Indeed.